This episode is brought to you by ICMP, the Institute of Contemporary Music Performance. ICMP is the UK's premier music education provider with top student satisfaction scores and students from across the globe. ICMP offers degrees, masters, and short courses in disciplines spanning the music industry, including performance, production, songwriting, business, marketing, and artist development. Discover your place in the music industry with ICMP at www.icmp.ac.uk/apply.
What am I saying?
This is MPW, the podcast with your host,
Zylo Aria. Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Liam Mice is a pioneering inventor, producer, and performer who has released 4 solo self-produced albums. Leah's all-hardware live performances combine her self-designed large instruments with dance beats, live-sampled vocals, and more. Leah has performed in 15 countries, holds a PhD in media and arts technology, and is currently the program leader of the MA at London's ICMP. Hi, Leah. It's great to have you on the podcast with us today. How is your morning going so far?
Going great.
That's good. That's good. So 9 a.m. for you there, I believe.
Yep.
And we are going to get into instrument making and all of the fascinating instruments that you have built yourself. But before we do that, I would love to know a little bit more about you. How did your career start in music, and how did you get to where you are today?
So I started out learning instruments when I was younger. I learned the piano and trumpet. I bought a bass when I was about 14, and then I was in some punk bands in the early 2000s. And after about 10 years of being in bands, I wanted to sort of be a solo artist and perform and produce my music myself. So I moved into that area. And then after a few years of that, I started to really get interested in building my own instruments to have on stage with me to expand the live show as a solo musician. So I started building these large sculptural instruments, and they sort of one prototype to the next, which prototype the next. So now I've made several large instruments that I perform on stage.
Okay. That's, amazing. And I think anyone that hasn't checked it out should have a look, because it's hard to explain how kind of larger than life some of these instruments are. And it was just fascinating to see some of the videos of them being played as well. So can you tell me as well, what is one event in your life that if you could, you would change?
I don't think I would change an event. I know that that's a bit of a cop-out, but everything kind of got me to this area that I'm in now, and I'm really excited to be working in designing instruments, but it took me a huge winding passage. Like, I just summarized in a couple of sentences about 20 years of my life. So, but I would say the biggest thing that helped me get into instrument design was getting into a funded PhD program in London. It was the Media and Arts Technology PhD at Queen Mary as part of the Augmented Instruments Lab. And that was the first sort of stepping stone to really becoming somebody who can learn all of the multidisciplinary aspects of digital musical instrument design, like coding, and then the physical hardware, the electronic kind of components and things like that. But I didn't start out down the traditional route. I was a touring artist and I was a composer and a performer. And so it was all that knowledge of my kind of days of touring and being on stage that I brought to instrument design. So I think, sure, you know, maybe I could have made different decisions, but then I don't think I would have ended up finding this art form. I think I may have ended up going down other paths along the way.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And that can be a common answer that we get of people just saying, you know, one thing has led to another. And with that as well, do you or did you imagine that 20 years ago, this is what you'd be doing, or has it been very organic that one thing has just flowed to the next thing?
Yeah, I have always loved instruments, and I have collected books on all different instruments. And I love going to galleries and seeing performances if I hear somebody's playing an obscure instrument or an instrument that they made themselves. But it wasn't until 2017 that I thought, you know what, I can actually build these instruments myself. So I think that it was always something I wanted to be a part of, but I didn't have the confidence to go and be a part of it until a certain moment when I said, you know what, I can't ignore this. I need to get amongst it.
So what did that look like when you were saying you didn't have the confidence to be a part of it? How did you then decide or take that step, and what was that step?
Well, a few of the really inspiring artists that I love the work of, for example, Andy Cavatorta, who has built instruments with Björk. He built the Gravity Harp, which is a 2-meter tall swinging pendulum instrument. It's beautiful. You can look it up on YouTube. And Björk toured with that. I mean, it involves robotics, physical hardware design, coding, you know, and then it's just this giant piece of gear that is custom built. And I thought, you know what, if I had my life again, I would love to study engineering and build something like that. And that's what I thought when I saw that the first time. I didn't think, oh, I love that and I'm inspired, I'd love to do that now. I thought I had, you know, chosen other careers for myself and that it would take too long to learn the engineering involved and things like that, or I thought I couldn't possibly do that myself. So it took several years of discovering other works like that. Kathy Hind is another designer of large sculptural instruments, and her work really, really inspired me when I came across it. And so after realizing this was the work that I really loved, I thought, okay, if these people can do it, I can probably do it. It'll take a lot of work. I'll have to prioritize it over other things. And that's what I did. But it took a few years of understanding that I could actually do it myself.
That's such a powerful realization. I think a lot of the times we see other people doing things and then you just put them on a pedestal and think, oh, well, they can do it, of course, but I'm just not in that league. But to have that realization that actually you're both human, so if they can do it, there's no reason you can't. That's incredible.
Especially when you're going to these gallery contacts, you're seeing the final work. It's probably been years in the making, so you're not seeing how this started off as a squiggle on paper or a model or the different iterations. And so when you see the final work that the artist wants to put on display, it's just so mind-blowing that you think, how did they ever get to that idea? But now I kind of understand all of the steps in the process, having done it myself.
For sure. So before we get more deeper into the instrument making part of it as well, can you tell me a random fact about yourself that maybe not many people in the industry know about you?
So a random fact is that I'm blind in one eye. And so right now I'm wearing a brown contact lens, but my natural sighted eye is blue. And so the reason I wear that contact lens is it's like a little eye patch that covers my blind eye. And if I don't do that, I have scrappy vision going on top of my sighted vision from my blind eye. So I need to block that. I need to wear a contact lens that blocks that. And I chose to wear a brown one so that this invisible disability becomes visible.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's incredible. And I guess most people wouldn't know until you told them. Is that right?
No. And when I walk around London with this one contact lens is brown and then my eye is blue, a lot of people say, oh my God, your eyes are different colours. And I'm like, no, actually, they're not. It's a contact lens that I need to wear.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay. That's a great fact to know. And does that, have there been issues with that in your life growing up as far as with the sight and having the one eye? Maybe that's a big question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a very, very long process of figuring out to where it is today. But I think it informs how I work with sound and music myself, because for several years I was only looking out of my blind eye. So I was really experiencing kind of the sonic world as a navigation tool and as like experiencing the world. Having that lived experience of blind vision, but that's quite a long story.
Okay, fair enough. But no, thank you for sharing that.
That's okay.
So getting back into instrument making. So You mentioned that the instruments that you were inspired by and your instruments as well, like they have so much involved in them, and you need to be familiar with areas like engineering, mechanics, electronics, software, all of that stuff. So how did you go about developing all these skills in these areas?
So what I did is I got myself involved in a community of makers, and the community that I joined was the Augmented Instruments Lab. And there in London, it's all, not all musicians, but all instrument makers. Some are working in different kind of multidisciplinary art forms, but for the most part, it's a lot of computer scientists who are also working in hardware instruments and doing research of what instruments are and how we use instruments and kind of what the capabilities are of instruments if we're designing the instruments of the future, ways to make instruments more accessible, and just different ways to think about the music that we're making as humans. So that was a very welcoming community that I joined. I became part of that community when I started my PhD. And when people ask me, how do you learn all of these different aspects of instrument design, I do say you kind of need a community around you, but you don't have to go the route that I did. You could join a maker space or form a community, or just start, you know, maybe find a mentor. But yeah, it is a lot that you need to learn, especially if you want to do the digital instrument building, because there's just a lot going on with the software and the hardware. So it is best to have some people around you who can ask.
Okay. Okay. So that kind of sounds to me like a music collaboration project almost, where you get people with different skill sets and come together with a joined project idea. So then coming to the actual process of making an instrument, how do you come up with the initial concept of the instrument?
I sort of daydream a bit and draw a bit on paper, but I'm not very good at drawing. So then I move it to a small model of what it could be. And then very quickly I move it, because I'm building large instruments that are larger than the performer. Most of my instruments are 2 meters wide and 2 meters tall. And I am wanting to work at that scale quite quickly, because I think there is a different aspect of design that comes out when you're working at the large scale rather than a smaller model of the large scale. So very quickly I move my idea up to scale, but I will work quickly at a large scale to iterate into the different advancements of the instrument, because instrument design, you're not going to just be able to draw it and then it's right, or make it and then it's right. I think what you need to do is test it out with a series of prototypes, and so that's what I do. And then when I'm ready to show it, I'll finish the whole way that it looks.
Okay, so to understand the process and the steps involved, you would start with a bit of daydreaming and come up with an idea, build a, you know, small scale model, and then take it up to the actual scale prototype. And at this point, I guess to generate sound the way you want to hear it, you will need those software elements and those digital elements as well. So where does that process come in? How do you go about communicating to these, you know, software developers potentially what you are aiming for, and how's that process work?
Oh, so I develop the sounds myself. Then I don't need to communicate with anybody. Although I do communicate with people who I may ask, I might say, my code isn't working. Can you help me with my code? But I know how to tell them, you know, I'm working on this, you know, for my instrument Chaos Bells, for instance. It uses a Karplus Strong physical modeling algorithm, which is a physical modeling of a string. And the way that instrument sounds is bell-like. And that's because I made it have all these extra partials to sound like a bell. But essentially, it's the sound of an electric guitar string. And then I've changed all the sounds in different areas of the instrument. But that was me writing the code. But I did need to kind of take it to the lab and say, hey, the code isn't working the way I want it to. Can anyone help me a little bit with unpicking this code? I can't seem to get only one of the tones to play at once. It's all the rest of them are reacting at the same time. So that was a bit of a complex coding issue, but it wasn't to do with the sound design. And that is part of why I wanted to study a PhD, is to be able to make my own sound design. Because I do agree, like, this is an interesting question. How do you put something that doesn't exist in the language space into the language space? Music is like a sonic language, and we need to translate it into words that we can talk about it, but maybe the meaning of that word to different people kind of conveys a different idea. And so I didn't really want to outsource the sound design to somebody else. I wanted to be using my own ears and tweaking it myself to get there. So that's why I took a long time learning how to write code and build these instruments, every aspect of them. That's not the only way that you have to go. It is the real long way around. But for me, it gave me a lot more creative freedom.
Okay. So was that learning to write the code part of your PhD?
Yes. Yeah. So when I started the PhD, I didn't have any background in computer science. But for the first year, I took master's level music science. I'm trying to remember what the course is called. I think it's called like computer science for it's anyway, it's a computer science master's based in like music and sound. So it's the type of degree people who work at Native Instruments or Ableton might have. I took all of those classes and I was just thrown in the deep end. And, like, you know, I learned to code C++ and MaxMSP, Pure Data, and these types of languages that are often used in coding of musical instruments and musical software. So, for example, like VSTs, so those are the sound effects and instruments for using in a DAW. I learned Juice for coding those in one of the modules. It was a lot of work to learn at all when I didn't have the background at all in computer science, but it's possible. And you can do courses like this online. You can get a tutor. You know, there are different ways if you didn't want to go the mainstream route, but the great thing about doing it in an institution is that you have around you other students. So I had around me a whole class who were working on the same project, who we could just make our own little study group, and they really helped me out a lot. And I had a great time when I was doing that first year of my PhD, even though it was some of the toughest work I've done in my life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. My gosh, it sounds very, very intense. And we have this question come up, you know, once in a while where people talk about, is the formal education route the best option, or would you recommend kind of going to or trying to do it yourself or with other short courses and things? And often the what comes out of that is the guests will say that the best thing was the community, which is something that's really hard to develop, whether it's on your own or doing some sort of short course. So that sounds as well like what was a real benefit for you in that PhD.
Yeah, but there are communities everywhere, so it's about tapping into a community. I think that would be the theme, is that whatever you're trying to do, I think you're going to go further and faster together. So if you find other people interested and you're kind of, even if you're not working on the same project, if you're just around each other, you have some other people to bounce ideas off of and you can share resources and it's just more fun anyway.
For sure. For sure. No, that definitely sounds like it would be more fun. That's good. So then talking about the materials that you use in the instruments, how important are they and how do you go about choosing the materials that you would use?
So sometimes the materials give me the idea of the instrument to begin with. So my latest instrument, which is called the Catastrophone, was an instrument that I designed for the purpose of trying to imagine how to make digital instruments that are eco-friendly. I look around my studio and there are a lot of plastic keyboard designed instruments or little boxes that are a lot of plastic and non-renewable materials. And I thought, why have we coupled kind of non-sustainable materials with digital, you know, art forms? It doesn't have to be that way. Actually, with a digital instrument, it could be made from anything. It's just the sensor that is sending information to the computer. The physical interface could be made from cardboard. It could be made from, you know, a leaf. And there are different instruments like that, but I'm working with larger than the performer instruments, and I haven't seen anything like that myself. So I started thinking about what materials are sustainable, what recycled materials could I use? And I went down an exploration of using paper and paper folding techniques. That was a little flimsy. So I went into using collage techniques. And that's how I came up with the instrument, the Catastrophone. I ended up collaging a lot of cat images onto cardboard, and they're the tiles that you play. Yeah, and then I took it to a show, and one of the people in the audience, I said, oh, to the audience, what should I call this instrument? I don't have a name for it. And then someone said the Catastrophone. So I was like, yeah, that's obviously what it needs to be called.
That's excellent.
Yeah. So, yeah, the materials, I think, is really important to think about, especially when you have agency over them. I mean, playing a violin, there's a reason that it's made from wood. It's even made from certain woods. There's a reason the string is made from the materials it's made from. But with digital instruments, we can decouple the material from the sonic output. And so we should be really thinking about that. And I hope that by my interrogation of this, it could maybe help the industry consider that as well. I know that the industry is trying to be as sustainable as possible with packaging. I'm seeing that happening now more and more. But we can go further and think about the actual materials that we're building these instruments from.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I love that that's been a significant thought process in the material that you've chosen in your instruments. And, yeah, hopefully we'll see more of that kind of change happen in the wider industry as well. And you're so right to think about non-digital instruments perhaps having certain materials for a reason, but we don't have to stick with that with the digital. And so your instruments seem to have digital elements in addition to kind of tactile, physical playing elements as well. So how do you feel like those two aspects complement each other in your instruments?
I mean, for me, the focal point at the moment is the physical. It's something that I think is really interesting is the use of the body when performing digital instruments. So I originally was in bands, and so I would be playing bass and I would be kind of moving my whole body into that instrument. But when I moved to becoming a solo artist, I started making music with my fingertips using small controllers with knobs or push buttons, and it was a completely different bodily experience. So by making these larger than the performer instruments, it brings back the full body interaction with to this digital music. And so I'm always thinking a lot about the physicality, but then there's just a sort of intuition about what sound should come out. And there's just trial and error. I like many different sounds. I wouldn't say I have one kind of sonic fingerprint of sounds. I sort of, my instruments so far are basically synthesizers, but I wouldn't say there's a specific sound that I, of synthesis that I would only work with. I'm exploring what works with that particular instrument, what I think it should sound like.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's a good point to mention of when you are performing digital music live, everything is so small and your fingertips are what you have to play with to kind of create those sounds and everything. And to have that full body experience sounds great and good to bring into the shows. So then if we talk about playing these instruments, you've got, you know, the ability to use your body in that. What is the process of actually learning to play the instrument that you have created? And you have other people playing them as well. So like, do you give them like a manual after you've worked it out, or is it just kind of everyone just uses it however it comes to them?
It's the latter for sure. I do not give them a manual on how to play it. I mostly just say, you know what, do what you want. Try not to break it, but don't hold back, because I made this so I can always fix it. And with that, I just let people go for it. The instrument I built for my PhD, which I've been performing around for a while now, is called Chaos Bells. And it was important for that research not to tell the performers how to use it, because we wanted to see what ideas they came up with. So in that research, they had 4 different weeks to rehearse with that instrument to make a performance that was for a web concert. And so they just were exploring the instrument and coming up with their own ways to perform it. And I think that's the most interesting thing to do with a new instrument, because I have coded it and made the sound design, but I actually am not the person performing these instruments for the most part. It's the people I'm collaborating with. And quite often they'll come up with ideas that I didn't even think of. Every time that I offer a new performer to play my instruments, they're coming up with ideas that I didn't have. So it's really interesting to see people working with them. And I certainly haven't come up with all of the ideas of how to perform my instruments.
That must be such a fascinating experience to create this instrument and then seeing other people just take it in their own direction and find totally different ways to use it than you might have thought of.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, very, very cool. So let's talk a little bit about as well accessibility in the instruments that you are creating. And I noticed that you created a one-handed violin as well. So is that something that you're thinking about in the forefront of these ideas that you come up with? And what's that thought process like?
Yeah, so I am really interested in accessible instrument design. That's another aspect of instrument design that is interesting, that we can decouple the shape of the interface or the materials it's made from with the sonic output. So we don't need to be as confined as with acoustic instruments with the shapes of them or the ways that they're interactive with. So they can be made in collaboration with performers with disabilities to be the most accessible way for them to be using those instruments. So that's something that I am really interested in. And part of my instrument building kind of art practice has given me the skills to then be able to collaboratively make accessible instruments. And so I feel like even though I have full dexterity in both of my arms, if I collaborate with a community who are looking to build one-handed instruments, I can take my knowledge of instrument design. They can bring their knowledge of what it's like, you know, navigating a world designed for people with two hands, you know, and bring that knowledge together with how the best kind of solution would be to building a one-handed instrument. And in this case, we were exploring the one-handed violin. So that was a project I did in collaboration with a charity called the OHMI Trust. That's OHMI, One-Handed Musical Instrument Trust. And their mission is to try to convert every two-handed instrument into a one-handed version to make it more accessible for people with upper limb disabilities. So that's a really inspiring community to be working with. And it's definitely a project I wouldn't take on myself without community involvement and without the input of people with lived experience in that domain. And having experience myself of, you know, blindness, although I don't have the same experience of people who don't have one-sighted eye, I have experience living with blindness. I do kind of have this natural kind of inclination to want to be working in the disability space and wanting to kind of progress all of the design ideas into that area, because I think there's still a lot of work to be done in that area and a lot of cool new ideas that haven't been explored yet.
For sure. Oh, that's great. And the OMI Trust sounds like incredible work that they're doing as well. So it's great that you could pair up with them and come up with a great idea. And hopefully they do get to that goal of every instrument being able to be played one-handed. So then also a question, Leah, on what is your dream instrument that you would love to make if you had no limitations?
No limitations. I'd love to make an instrument to put on the moon that would just make sound with the tides and I don't know. I'm just making this up right now. I don't
How
know.
Cool is
I do
that?
Sit around thinking. I sometimes just sit around and think about these types of things. You know, yeah, why not have, let's have some space instruments.
How
in space there isn't sound, so how would it work?
Well, that's what I was
know.
Thinking actually.
Let's think about
like,
it.
Is there also, like you were saying, with the tides, are there tides on the moon? I don't think so.
The moon controls the tides of the earth.
It does, yes, it does. But I don't know if there is like wind or because it doesn't have an atmosphere, but it's a great question and a great thought on that. And yeah, I wonder if is it a little bit like the if the tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, is there a sound?
If I play a concert and nobody comes, did it happen?
Oh, that's good. Coming to our speed quiz then, Leah, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. So it's five quick fire this or that question. First one, roller coasters or water slides?
I'll take water slides.
Science or maths?
Ooh, science.
Ballads or dance beats?
Dance beats.
Okay. Mac or PC?
Mac.
Quality or vibe?
Vibe.
Oh my gosh, that was one of our speediest quizzes, I would say. One of them always trips people up. Very good. Nice one. So coming to our top tips then, can you tell me what is your one top career tip?
My top career tip is to be friendly and try to think of ways to collaborate in a way that's really genuine, that every collaborator gets something out of it that they really want, and especially a good time.
Love that. That's so good. Cool. And what is your one top self-care tip?
Get enough sleep, even if that means going to bed at 9 p.m. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah, 9 p.m. doesn't even sound early to me anymore. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I've just gotten earlier and earlier with my age, which is not that much. So who knows? By the time I'm 70, maybe it's going to be like 5:30. I'm not sure. But lots of sleep. Great one. Love that. And what is your one top general life tip?
My general life tip is think about priorities. And I think like health and well-being has to be number one.
So true. And I think a lot of us don't prioritize these things, and health, including I would say physical and mental as well. Yeah, really, really good point, because nothing else will happen if those things fall over. So great. Great thing to mention. Thank you so much, Leah. And what have you got on for the rest of the day?
Today I am preparing for my show tomorrow. I'm playing in Brighton. And I've just received the Ableton Push 3 standalone in the post. Ooh. So I'm converting my live set, that the aspect that I play with Push, which is kind of how I get my dance beats to kind of go with the other instruments. So I'm converting my set over to that new piece of kit. And I'm very excited. It's like Christmas Day.
Oh, that's very exciting. But also like pretty, I don't know if I'd have the guts to do that the day before the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When are you going to do it? No, I think it's great to take it out for a test drive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool. Love that. Well, enjoy. That sounds like an incredible day for you. And thank you so much for sharing your tips with us on this episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye.
My biggest three takeaways from Leah's episode was firstly, the realization that if your mentors can do it, then there is no reason that you can't. And to realize that there's nothing setting you apart from those that are doing the things that you always wanted to do and for you to just go for it. My second biggest takeaway was to find a community to help you do what you want to do, no matter what that is. And there are often skills that you can share with others and that others can share with you. Along those lines, my last takeaway was to find genuine collaborations where everyone involved gets something from being a part of that project. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode and we look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks.